and welcome to Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. I want to thank you for tuning into the show today. Now, almost 4 months since the WHO declared COVID-19 as a global pandemic, the deadly virus continues to wreak havoc across the world. And in Africa, after months of lockdowns in major cities across the continent, the phased reopenings and relaxed lockdown restrictions have been set back by reports that numbers of infections continue to rise in countries like South Africa, Kenya, and many others. And health experts are warning that ending lockdowns early could actually spur infections in countries that already have weak healthcare systems. In Tanzania, the government announced that it's reopening the country for tourism after its president declared the country free of COVID-19. But even though this move has been welcomed by many in the industry, Charles Combe reports that some tour operators worry that Tanzania's lack of transparency on the extent of infections in the country will keep foreign tourists away.
Tanzania's Mikumi National Park last year attracted around 50,000 tourists, about 40% of them foreigners. The coronavirus pandemic brought foreign tourism to a halt in March when international flights and parks were closed. The park is seeing visitors slowly return after the government in May allowed flights and tourism to resume, but they are mainly locals. Yasir El Haq is a Tanzanian tourist.
We came to Mikumi to come and refresh from the quarantine that we were before from the coronavirus, just to have a bit of fresh air. So we came here for the weekend, me and my fellow riders, as you can see.
President John Magufuli in May declared Tanzania had defeated the virus, a claim that health experts and its neighbors dismiss. Dozens of Tanzanian truckers have since tested positive for COVID-19 at Kenya's border, while Tanzania has refused to release coronavirus infection figures since April. Nonetheless, Tanzanian authorities say this is the right time to open up for tourists. Minister of Natural Resources and Tourism Hamis Kigwangala says his ministry is observing all preventive measures.
In Tanzania, to the contrary, the number of cases and hospitalizations, deaths, has completely gone down over the past few weeks. And it's the right timing as well, because we put in place all the necessary measures for prevention and control of the spread of COVID-19 in the country.
But not everyone in Tanzania's tourism industry is following the herd. Some say the government's lack of honesty with the coronavirus infection numbers could keep visitors away. Raymond Kisasembe is the managing director of Patriot Tours and Safaris Limited.
Wasiwasi upo kwa sababu wateja tunawategemea.
Kisasembe says there are worries because customers that they depend on are those from outside the country. He adds that, as it is known, domestic tourism does not go that far to benefit those who are working in the tourism sector. Tanzania's tourism industry accounts about 70% of the country's gross domestic product, while opening to tourists could bolster the economy. How Tanzania handles the pandemic could have a much longer term effect. Charles Combe for VOA News, Morogoro, Tanzania.
Listening to Upfront on the Voice of America, my name is Jackson Vunganyi. Now, many African countries have begun a phased reopening of their economies, allowing for people to go back to work and businesses to operate under strict guidelines like social distancing and requiring everyone to wear masks, especially when they're in public. But how are people responding to these restrictions? Well, we hit the streets of Kampala and we had your opinions.
I have the mask, but you found us here negotiating about something. You get, and you cannot put a mask when you are negotiating with your fellow what? With your fellow friend. So, and it came to Uganda. Let me tell you, Uganda. Uganda is where but people are wearing masks when they are seeing policemen. Let me tell you this. People are putting on masks when they have seen a policeman, but are not putting masks as they want themselves. So, if you push me to put on a mask when I'm hungry, you are lying yourself as a government. See, we have heard of some countries, eh? They are giving their people mobile money caches. Eh? But for us, you told us that the government told us that they're going to give us posho. But for me, I've never seen posho. So if I see a policeman, I remove my mask in the pocket and I put it. If the policeman pass away, I put it on my pocket. Am I fighting for COVID or you get?
And by name of November was Petro. You know why I'm not putting on mask? Because if I wear a mask, I cannot breathe very well if I put on a mask. That's why I used to keep my mask in what? In my car bag. So for emergencies, I just keep this mask here because I know the police may come and then they take me because they arrest me that because I'm not putting on a mask or they beat me because I'm not putting on. But I don't, normally, I don't use it. I'm not used in wearing masks because I cannot breathe very well. I have my problems. That's why I don't wear masks.
You're listening to Upfront on the Voice of America as we continue to cover the COVID-19 pandemic and its impact on the global community. We are also covering the wave of protests against racism and police brutality triggered by the death of George Floyd in Minnesota. These protests continue across the US and they are spreading also through parts of Europe, where a conversation on Europe's colonial legacy has gained momentum, and this has led to the removal of statues and monuments with racist colonial legacies. This week in the DRC, as millions of Congolese celebrate 60th anniversary of independence from Belgium, they will also be celebrating the fall of one of the most prominent symbols of the colonization and plunder of their country, that is King Leopold II. Inspired by the Black Lives Matter movement in America, protesters in Belgian cities have taken down several statues depicting King Leopold II, whose 23-year-long administration over the Congo Free State is responsible for the death of an estimated 10 million people, which earned him the name the Butcher of the Congo. And one of the most extensive accounts of this time period is captured in a critically acclaimed book titled King Leopold's Ghost, written by Professor Adam Hochschild. I reached Professor Hochschild via phone in California. And he tells me that even though Leopold ruled over the Congo like it was his personal property, he never at any time stepped foot in that region.
So Professor Adam, thank you very much for joining us. Let me start off by asking you about this person, King Leopold. What drove his interest in the Congo and how did he pique interest in it?
Well, Leopold inherited the Belgian monarchy. He became King of Belgium in 1865 when he was 30 years old. But he was a very, very ambitious man. And he became a king at a time when it was no longer so much fun to be a king in Europe because you had to share power with elected parliaments. And throughout the second half of the 19th century, European monarchs were steadily losing power to the electorate. Leopold wanted some part of the world where he could reign supreme and where he could make a lot of money. And he got in right at the beginning of what's often talked about as the European scramble for Africa, where the major countries in Europe competed with each other to grab portions of the African continent. And it's amazing how much they grabbed in such a short time. Mm. In 1870, 80% of the African continent was under the rule of indigenous kings, chiefs, leaders of one sort or another. By 35 years later, virtually all of it was either white settler colonies like South Africa run by their white settlers, or it was European colonies or so-called protectorates of one sort or another. King Leopold got in at the beginning of this process. The Belgian government was not interested in colonies because they thought that was an extravagance for a small country with no navy and no merchant marine. But for Leopold, that was not a problem. He thought, well, I'll get my own personal colony. So he hired the explorer Henry Morton Stanley to stake it out for him. And by 1885, he'd gotten first the United States and then all the major nations of the world to recognize the Congo, the same territory roughly as the boundaries of the Democratic Republic of Congo today, as belonging to him personally.
Not the country of Belgium or the kingdom of Belgium, but for him as a king, personally, it was his personal.
It was his personal possession, and he talked about himself as its proprietor. And it was more than 70 times the size of Belgium. It remained in his personal possession for 23 years. And then in 1908, a year before he died, it became the Belgian Congo. But up to that point, it belonged to him personally, and he made an enormous fortune from it during that time, chiefly by developing a forced labor system to gather what was then the territory's most lucrative commodity, which was wild rubber. And basically, his soldiers would go into village after village, would hold the women hostage in order to force the men of each village to go deep into the rainforest for days and eventually weeks out of each month and gather a monthly quota of wild rubber. And you can actually see photographs of these women hostages in chains.
What was happening in the world at the time? What was driving the need for this rubber?
Good question. It really began in 1887 when for the first time they invented the inflatable bicycle tire. And then suddenly there was a big demand for rubber for bicycle tires, and very soon after that for automobiles, which really began in the 1890s. There was also a big market for rubber in industrial uses of all kinds, belts, rubber belts in factories, rubber coatings on the telegraph and telephone wires, which were spreading all over the world. So there was a huge market for rubber. But in order to plant a plantation of rubber trees, have them grow to maturity where you can begin harvesting rubber from them, that takes about 15 years. So the people who could really make a killing were people like Leopold, who had sections of the African rainforest where rubber grew wild, not as trees, but as vines, which twined around palm trees or other trees up to where they could get some sunlight.
Were there other countries interested in that region? Did they ever have to fight with him for potentially with this, you know, vast wealth that he was controlling?
Well, when Leopold got his hands on the territory and got, as I mentioned, the U.S. and all the other major countries to recognize it as his own, it was before they had discovered that rubber was really the valuable commodity there. That came a few years later. At the time, they were thinking mainly about ivory. Other countries also seized the colonies in the region, Britain, France, Germany, Portugal. And those that had wild rubber, which were not the British colonies, but the French and German colonies and part of the Portuguese colony of Angola, they saw how much money Leopold was making by this system of forced labor. And within 5 or 10 years, all of them adopted it also, with the similar very high death rate that existed in the country.
They instituted the same policies of torture and plunder that Leopold was using in the Congo too.
Exactly, the same business of holding the women hostage in order to turn the men into forced laborers. And you needed hostages to do that. You couldn't just chain people up and send them into the rainforest to gather rubber, because these wild rubber vines were scattered very widely. And when those near a village got tapped dry, the men might have to walk miles and miles to find other rubber vines that they could draw the rubber up.
In case you're just joining us, this is Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. Joining me on the show today is acclaimed author Adam Hochschild. We are talking about the legacy of King Leopold, whose brutal rule over the Congo is responsible for the death of millions of Congolese. And as Congolese mark 60 years of independence this month, activists are calling on the government of Belgium to reassess its colonial legacy, and that pressure prompted Belgium's King Philippe to express his deep regrets for his country's brutal colonial rule over the Congo.
Talk to us a little bit in detail of some of the things that he did to the villagers for them to be able to meet whatever monthly quota they had to gather their rubber.
Well, the soldiers were very demanding because the white officers who commanded these black troops who enforced the system were paid on the basis of how much rubber was gathered in their district. Maybe half of these white officers were Belgians, the other half came from Europe, some from the United States. And they would enforce this system, as I mentioned, first of all, by using the women of each village as hostage, holding them in chains. And then by forcing the men, by doing that, to go deep into the rainforest and gather this rubber. Many of the men ended up essentially being worked to death. Many of the women hostages were raped by the colonial troops. And you can find these white officers in their diaries talking about the problem of African troops getting out of control and raping the hostages. And then, of course, when you have in an indigenous community, you've got the women all held as hostages, the men turned into forced laborers. That means there's nobody left to plant and harvest crops, to go hunting, to go fishing, to do all the things through which a community normally feeds itself. And in addition to this, the army would requisition supplies from these villages and say, you know, we're stationing 20 soldiers here for 6 months, you need to feed them. So food became extremely scarce. There was near famine in much of these rainforest areas. And when you have a large population of people who are traumatized by being forced laborers, families are broken up and separated by this, and there isn't enough food, they very often succumb to diseases that they might otherwise have survived. In addition to this, tens of thousands of people, maybe hundreds of thousands, fled to try to avoid getting impressed as forced laborers, but the only place they could go was deep in the rainforest where there was no food, no shelter, and most of them did not survive. Tens of thousands more were shot down in the rebellions that repeatedly broke out against these regimes. But, you know, Leopold's soldiers had modern repeating rifles, machine guns, small mobile cannons, steamboats to get around. The Africans resisting them had, if anything, just primitive muskets left over from slave trading days. Mm-hmm. So from all these causes, the best estimate is that between about 1880 and 1920, the population of this territory was roughly slashed in half, from somewhere around 20 million people at the beginning of that time to near 10 million people at the end of that time.
Almost 13 million people dead. In a span of 20-something years.
Yeah.
When did he leave, and most importantly, how did he finally leave? Like, was it that the rubber was not lucrative anymore? Was he pushed out?
No, the rubber remained lucrative, and Leopold owned the territory for 23 years, but then there was growing pressure on him to give it up because there were human rights agitators, principally in England, but also in the United States and in other European countries, who were shocked at the atrocities of this system. And they felt mistakenly, I think, that it was so brutal because this possession was, this colony was the personal possession of one man. And that if the territory could just be taken out of the king's hands, the system would become much less brutal. I think they had a too simplified way of thinking about things because, as I mentioned, you know, the other European colonies in the region
were already doing the same thing.
Were using the same system.
Right.
But nonetheless, there was greater and greater pressure on Leopold to give up the Congo. So finally, in 1908, he made a deal with the Belgian government where he said, all right, we'll let it become the Belgian Congo, but you have to pay me for it. So, in effect, he sold the Congo to Belgium. The payment was to be in installments. It was never fully made because he died the following year, and then a couple of years after that, the First World War began and Belgium was occupied. But the arrogance of this man saying, I'll only give up my colony if you pay me for it.
Right. How many times did he visit the Congo?
He never went there because he knew statistics which were not released to the public, which were that basically one out of every three white Europeans who went to the Congo died there of tropical diseases. Because
for his life, that's why he didn't go.
Yeah, especially in the early years, you know, they didn't know how malaria and yellow fever worked. They had no cure for them. And with that high death rate, Leopold, who was something of a germaphobe to begin with, simply did not want to set foot in the Congo. So he never went there.
Okay, so let's fast forward to, I guess, what is happening right now in the world, and especially in Belgium. The perception of Leopold among Belgians, how is he understood by the Congolese, and how different is that from how Belgians think about him and his place in history?
Well, I think most Congolese have some sense of what a terrible period this was. And of course, you know, many of these atrocities continued into the time that it was the Belgian Congo, because basically, you know, forced labor was the foundation of the economy in most colonies in Africa south of the Sahara before the Second World War. So forced labor continued, not quite as brutally, because around 1920, the Belgian colonial officials who'd taken over from Leopold realized how high the death rate was. And you can actually find them saying this on paper, saying, unless we change the system somewhat, we're not going to have any labor force left. So it was at that point that they began moderating the forced labor system, introducing medical clinics to keep workers healthy, and so forth. But I think most Congolese have some sense of just how brutal this system was. In Belgium, though, however, here was this quite small country that had this huge colony, the largest colony in sub-Saharan Africa. And, you know, most Belgians for decades like to think of themselves as having gone there to spread Christianity and bring civilization, bring literacy, and so forth. And, you know, they were certainly good people, like missionaries, priests, teachers, doctors, and so forth, who did that kind of work. But overall, I think all colonialism is basically based on trying to extract wealth from the colony and bring it back to the mother country. I think this has begun to change in recent years, in part because there is now something of a population of African descent living in Belgium itself. I don't know what the exact numbers are. It's probably not more than 60 or 70,000. You know, people whose ancestors came there from Congo or from Rwanda. But these folks have been demanding, you know, it's time to take down those statues of Leopold. And I think that combined with the ricochet around the world of the George Floyd video has just had a tremendous effect. Mm. And some of those statues of Leopold have come down. And then just in the last 24 hours, because, you know, the day that we're talking here, June 30th, is actually the 60th anniversary of Congo independence in 1960, the King of Belgium made a sort of half-hearted apology for bad things that happened under Leopold and subsequently.
I mean, it wasn't really an apology, more of an acknowledgement that bad things happened.
That's right.
So the question, I guess, is, how much of Belgian economy still depends on the Congo? And is it fair to say that Leopold never really left, when you think about it, 60 years after independence of the DRC, the condition, the situation in the DRC right now, whether the economic, political situation?
I don't think you can say that the Belgian economy today depends on the Congo, but you can certainly say that the ancestors of many of the wealthiest people in Belgium today drew their wealth from the Congo, mostly in the period before 1960. There was a survey done, I believe, in 2009, where someone found that 9 of the wealthiest 23 families in Belgium the roots of their fortune were in the colonial Congo.
Leopold's wealth still being in
there. And the wealth of the Belgian royal family still descends from Leopold's earnings there.
I know you did talk a little bit about this, but what does this toppling of his statue tell us about this moment in history, that it is taking place all the way in Europe, but the spark was very much from the US? Why is this happening right now after so many years of people, you know, calling out Leopold's crimes?
Yeah, well, I think very often when an injustice in one part of the world is extremely stark and dramatic, it ripples across the globe in very moving ways. I think we've seen that in the last couple of weeks with the George Floyd video. It is just so stark and so brutal that that image shocked people everywhere. We've seen it in the past too. I think the resistance movement in South Africa, Nelson Mandela's nobility, the Sharpeville massacre there some 60 years ago and so forth. These were things that ricocheted around the world. And certainly the last few weeks we've seen that again. And I think it's a good thing when people see an injustice in the present in one country, it makes them ask about what are the injustices here that we also have to acknowledge? What are the historical injustices that led to that? Because of course, when you see George Floyd being murdered, you know that behind that murder lies, you know, centuries of the heritage of slavery in the United States. This is what, you know, leads to the attitudes of somebody like that policeman who murdered him.
Right, right. As we end our conversation, Professor Hochschild, I wanted to ask you, and today is the 60th anniversary of the independence of the DRC. What are some of the ghosts that are still haunting, Leopold's ghosts that are still haunting the DRC now?
I would say the biggest ghost is this. The whole system of colonialism, under colonialism, government, as experienced by people in Africa, was basically an organized system of plunder. Government departments of every kind essentially existed to speed the theft of raw materials out of the country and get them to Europe. When the Congo became independent, rather suddenly in 1960, there had been no experience whatever of self-government, you know, even allowing people to have local elections or anything like that. And I think the experience of government as an organized system of plunder continued. For 32 years, the fairly newly independent Congo was ruled by the dictator Mobutu Sese Seko, who made a personal fortune even greater than that of Leopold's. He had a much more developed economy to plunder, and he also had strong support from the United States. He turned that country almost into a private colony of his own. After his downfall and death in 1997, the country has mainly been run by the Kabila dynasty, father and son, who've also amassed a considerable fortune, and who, even though the younger Kabila is now officially out of power, he has enormous influence behind the scenes. And I think the experience of government as an organized system of plunder has continued. And that's a very difficult heritage to get rid of.
That was Professor Adam Hochschild, author of the critically acclaimed book, King Leopold's Ghost. And I want to thank you, our listeners, who tuned into the show today, whether you're listening on radio across the continent or you tuned in via the web. You can listen to other episodes of our show right there on our website at voanews.com. Just look for Upfront. Also, check us out on our social media platforms. We are on Twitter, YouTube, Instagram, and on Facebook, where you can subscribe, like our page, let us know what you think about our show and what topics you want us to cover. Until next time, my name is Jackson Vunganyi. Goodbye, Africa.